the marker that will disappear and yet be there 50 years later. How little of her story is revealed in his child's face. Its youngness is all he can see, so very new in the cycle, with nothing as yet totally defined. Time is so powerfully present in her face. The skull is soft. The flare of the unstructured nose is the whole nose. The color of her eyes, the white, white whiteness. The limpid blue. Eyes unclouded. It's all unclouded. But the eyes particularly, windows. Washed windows with nothing yet of the revelation of what's within. The history in her brow of the embryo. The dried apricots that are her ears. Delicious. If once you started eating them, you never stop. The little ears, always older than she is. The ears that were never just 4 years old, and yet hadn't really changed since she was 14 months. The preternatural fineness of her hair, the health of it. More reddish, more like his mother's than his then, still touched with fire then. The smell of the whole day in her hair, the carefreeness, the abandon of that body in his arms. The cat-like abandon to the all-powerful father, the reassuring giant. It is true, in the abandon of her body to him, she excites an instinct for reassurance that is so abundant that it must be close to what Dawn says she felt when she was lactating. What he feels when his daughter leaves the earth to leap into his arms is the absoluteness of their intimacy. And built into it always is the knowledge that he's not going too far, that he cannot, that it is an enormous freedom and an enormous pleasure, the equivalent of her breastfeeding bond with Dawn. It's true, it's undeniable. He was wonderful at it, and so was she. So wonderful. How did all this happen to this wonderful kid? She stuttered. So what? What was the big deal? How did all this happen to this perfectly normal child? Unless this is the sort of thing that does happen to the wonderful, perfectly normal kids. The nuts don't do these things. The normal kids do. You protect her and protect her, and she's unprotectable. If you don't protect her, it's unendurable. If you do protect her, it's unendurable. It's all unendurable. The awfulness of her terrible autonomy. The worst of the world had taken his child. If only that beautifully chiseled body had never been born. He calls his brother. It's the wrong brother from whom to seek consolation, but what can he do? When it comes to consolation, it's always the wrong brother, the wrong father, the wrong mother, the wrong wife, which is why one must be content to console oneself and be strong and go on in life consoling others. But he needs some relief from this rape, needs the rape taken out of his heart where it's stabbing him to death. He cannot put up with it. And so he calls the only brother he has. If he had another brother, he would call him. But for a brother, he has only Jerry, and Jerry has only him. For a daughter, he has only Mary. For a father, she has only him. There's no way around any of this. Nothing else can be made to come true. It's 5:30 on a Friday afternoon. Jerry's in the office seeing post-operative patients. But he can talk, he says. The patients can wait. What is it? What's wrong with you? He has only to hear Jerry's voice, the impatience in it, the acerbic cocksuredness in it, to think, he's no good to me. I found her. I just came from Mary. I found her in Newark. She's here in a room. I saw her. What this girl has been through, what she looks like, where she lives, you can't imagine. You cannot begin to imagine it. He proceeds to recount her story, not breaking down, trying to repeat what she said to him about where she had been, how she had lived, and what had become of her, trying to get it into his head, his own head, trying to find in his head the room for it all when he could not even find enough room for that room in which he lived. He comes closest to crying when he tells his brother that she had twice been raped. Are you done? asked Jerry. What? If you're done, if that's it, tell me what you're going to do now. What are you going to do now, Seymour?
I don't know what there is to do. She did it. She blew up Hamlin's. She killed Conlon.
He cannot tell him about Oregon and the other three. She did it on her own.
Well, sure, she did it. Who did we think did it? Where is she now? In that room?
Yes, it's awful.
Then go back to the room and get her.
I can't. She won't let me. She wants me to leave her alone.
Fuck what she wants. Get back in your fucking car. Get over there. Drag her out of the fucking room by her hair. Sedate her. Tie her up. Listen to me. You're paralyzed. I'm not the one who thinks holding his family together is the most important thing in existence. You are. Get back in that car and get her.
That won't work. I can't drag her. There's more to this than you understand. Once you get beyond the point of forcing somebody back into their house, then what? There's bravado about it, but then what? It's complicated. Too complicated. It won't work your way.
That's just the way it works. She killed three other people.
She has killed four people.
Fuck the four people. What's the matter with you? You're acceding to her the way you acceded to your father, the way you've acceded to everything in your life.
She was raped. She's crazy. She's gone crazy. You just look at her and you know twice she was raped.
What do you think was going to happen? You sound surprised. Of course she got raped. Either get off your ass and do something, or she's going to get raped for a third time. Do you love her, or don't you love her?
How can you ask that?
Well, you forced me to. Please, not now. Don't tear me down. Don't undermine me. I love my daughter. I never loved anything more in the world. As a thing.
What? What is that?
As a thing. You loved her as a fucking thing, the way you love your wife. Oh, if someday you could become conscious of why you're doing what you're doing. Do you know why? Do you have any idea? Because you're afraid of creating a bad scene. You're afraid of letting the beast out of the bag.
What are you talking about? What beast? What beast?
No, he's not expecting perfect consolation, but this attack?
Why is he launching this attack without even the pretext of consoling?
Why, when he has just explained to Jerry how everything has turned out thousands and thousands of times worse than the worst they had expected?
What are you? Do you know?
What you are is you're always trying to smooth everything over. What you are is always trying to be moderate. What you are is never telling the truth if you think it's going to hurt somebody's feelings. What you are is you're always compromising. What you are is always complacent. What you are is always trying to find the bright side of things. The one with the manners. The one who abides everything patiently. The one with the ultimate decorum, the boy who never breaks the code. Whatever society dictates, you do. Decorum. Decorum is what you spit in the face of. Well, your daughter spit in it for you, didn't she? For people, quite a critique she has made of decorum.
If he hangs up, he'll be alone in that hallway behind the man who is waiting, behind the man who is down on the stairs, tearing at Mary. He will be seeing everything he does not want to see, knowing everything he cannot stand to know. He cannot sit there imagining the rest of that story. If he hangs up, he'll never know what Jerry has to say after he says all this stuff that he, for some reason, wants to say about the beast.
What beast?
All his relations with people are like this. It isn't an attack on me. It's Jerry. Nobody can control him. He was born like this. I knew that before I called him. I've known it all my life. We do not live the same way. A brother who isn't a brother. I panic. I am in a panic. This is panic. I call the worst person to call in the world. This is a guy who wields a knife for a living. Remedies what is ailing with a knife. Cuts out what is rotting with a knife. I am on the ropes. I am dealing with something that nobody can deal with. And for him, it's business as usual. He just keeps coming at me with his knife. I'm not the renegade, the Swede says. I'm not the renegade. You are.
No, you're not the renegade. You're the one who does everything right.
I don't follow this. You say that like an insult.
Angrily, he says, what the hell is wrong with doing things right?
Nothing. Nothing.
Except that's what your daughter has been blasting away at all her life. You don't reveal yourself to people, Seymour. You keep yourself a secret. Nobody knows what you are. You certainly never let her know who you are. That's what she's been blasting away at, the facade. What are your fucking norms? Take a good look at what she did to your norms.
I don't know what you want from me.
You've always been too smart for me. Is this your response? Is this it? You win the trophy. You always make the right move. You're loved by everybody. You marry Miss New Jersey, for God's sake. They're thinking for you. Why did you marry her? For the appearance? Why do you do everything? For the appearance? I loved her. I opposed my own father. I loved her so much. Jerry's laughing. Is that what you believe? You really think you stood up to him? You married her because you couldn't get out of it. Dad raked her over the coals in his office, and you sat there and didn't say shit. Well, isn't that true? My daughter is in that room, Jerry. What is this all about? But Jerry doesn't hear him. He hears only himself. Why is this Jerry's grand occasion to tell his brother the truth? Why does someone, in the midst of your worst suffering, decide the time has come to drive home, disguised in the form of character analysis, all the contempt they have been harboring for you all these years? What in your suffering makes their superiority so fulsome, so capacious, makes the expression of it so enjoyable? Why this occasion for launching his protest at living in the shadow of me? Why? If he had to tell me all this, couldn't he have told it to me when I was feeling my oats? Why does he even believe he's in my shadow? Miami's biggest cardiac surgeon, the heart victim savior, Dr. Lvov. Dad, he fucking let you slide through, don't you know that? If Dad had said, look, you'll never get my approval for this, never. I am not having grandchildren, half this and half that, then you would have had to make a choice. But you never had to make a choice, never, because he let you slide through. Everybody has always let you slide through, and that is why to this day, nobody knows who you are. You are unrevealed. That is the story, Seymour. Unrevealed. That is why your own daughter decided to blow you away. You are never straight about anything, and she hated you for it. You keep yourself a secret you don't choose ever. Why are you saying this? What do you want me to choose? What are you talking about? You think you know what a man is? You have no idea what a man is. You think you know what a daughter is? You have no idea what a daughter is. You think you know what this country is? You have no idea what this country is. You have a false image of everything. All you know is what a fucking glove is. This country is frightening. Of course she was raped. What kind of company do you think she was keeping? Of course out there she was going to get raped. This is an old Rimrock, old buddy. She's out there, old buddy, in the USA. She enters that world, that loopy world out there, and what's going on out there? What do you expect? A kid from Rimrock, New Jersey? Of course she doesn't know how to behave out there. Of course the shit hits the fan. What could she know? She's like a wild child out there in the world. She can't get enough of it. She's still acting up. A room off Makata Highway? And why not? Who wouldn't? You prepare her for life, milking these cows? What kind of life? Unnatural, artificial, all of it. Those assumptions you live with. You're still in your old man's dream world, Seymour. Still up there with Lou Lvov in Glove Heaven. A household tyrannized by gloves, bludgeoned by gloves. The only thing in life, ladies' gloves. Does he still tell the great one about the woman who sells the gloves washing her hands in the sink between each color? Oh, where is that outmoded America, that decorous America where a woman had 25 pairs of gloves? Your kid blows your norms to kingdom come, Seymour, and you still think you know what life is. Life is just a short period of time in which we're alive. Meredith Lvov, 1964. You wanted Miss America? Well, you got her, with a vengeance. She's your daughter. You wanted to be a real American jock, a real American Marine, a real American hotshot with a beautiful Gentile babe on your arm? You long to belong, like everybody else, to the United States of America? Well, you do now, big boy, thanks to your daughter. The reality of this place is right up in your kisser now. With the help of your daughter, you're as deep in the shit as a man can get. The real American crazy shit. America amok. America amok. God damn it, Seymour. God damn you. If you were a father who loved his daughter, thunders Jerry into the phone. And the hell with the convalescent patients waiting in the corridor for him to check out their new valves and new arteries to tell how grateful they are to him for their new lease on life. Jerry shouts away, shouts all he wants if it's shouting he wants to do, and the hell with the rules of the hospital. He is one of the surgeons who shouts. If you disagree with him, he shouts. If you cross him, he shouts. If you just stand there and do nothing, he shouts. He does not do what hospitals tell him to do, or fathers expect him to do, or wives want him to do. He does what he wants to do. does as he pleases, tells people just who and what he is every minute of the day, so that nothing about him is a secret, not his opinions, his frustrations, his urges, neither his appetite nor his hatred. In the sphere of the will, he is unequivocating, uncompromising. He is king. He does not spend time regretting what he has or has not done or justifying to others how loathsome he can be. The message is simple. You'll take me as I come. There is no choice. He cannot endure swallowing anything he just lets loose. And these two are brothers, the same parent's sons, one for whom the aggression's been bred out, the other for whom the aggression's been bred in. If you were a father who loved his daughter, Jerry shouts at the Swede, you would have never left her in that room. You would have never let her out of your sight. The Swede is in tears at his desk. It's as though Jerry's been waiting all his life for this phone call. That something's grotesquely out of whack has made him furious with his older brother. And now there's nothing he will not say. All his life, thinks the Swede, waiting to lay into me with these terrible things. People are infallible. They pick up on what you want, and then they don't give it to you. I didn't want to leave her, says the Swede. You don't understand. You don't want to understand. That isn't why I left her. It killed me to leave her. You don't understand, but you won't. Why do you say I don't love her? This is terrible. Horrible. He suddenly sees his vomit on her face, and he cries out, everything is horrible. Now you're getting it. Right. My brother is developing the beginning of a point of view, a point of view of his own instead of everybody else's point of view. Taking something other than the party line. Good. Now we're getting somewhere. Thinking, becoming just a little untranquilized. Everything is horrible. And so what are you going to do about it? Nothing. Look, do you want me to come up there and get her? Do you want me to get it? Yes or no? No. Then why did you call me? I don't know. To help me? Nobody can help you. You're a hard man. You're a hard man with me. Yeah, I don't come off looking very good. I never do. Ask our father if I do. You're the one who always comes off looking good. And look where it got you. Refusing to give offense, blaming yourself, tolerant and respect for every position. Sure, it's liberal. I know. A liberal father. What does that mean? What is at the center of it? Always holding things together, and look where the fuck it's got you. I didn't make the war in Vietnam. I didn't make the television war. I didn't make Lyndon Johnson, Lyndon Johnson. You forget where this begins. Why she threw the bomb? The fucking war. No, you didn't make the war. You made the angriest kid in America. Ever since she was a kid, every word she spoke was a bomb. I gave her all I could. Everything. Everything. I gave everything. I swear to you, I gave everything. And now he's crying easily. There's no line between him and his crying. And an amazing new experience it is. He is crying as though crying like this has been the great aim of his life, as though all along crying like this was his most deeply held ambition. And now he has achieved it. Now that he remembers everything he gave and everything she took, all the spontaneous giving and taking that had filled their lives, and that one day, inexplicably, despite whatever Jerry might say, despite all the blame that it is his pleasure now to heap upon the Swede, quite inexplicably, became repugnant to her. You talk about what I'm dealing with as though anybody could deal with it. But nobody could deal with it. Nobody. Nobody has the weapons for this. You think I'm inept? You think I'm inadequate? If I'm inadequate, where are you going to get people who are adequate? Do you understand what I'm saying? What am I supposed to be? What are other people if I'm inadequate? Oh, I understand you. Crying easily was always about as difficult for the Swede as losing his balance when he walked or deliberately being a bad influence on somebody. Crying easily was something he sometimes almost envied in other people. But whatever chunks and fragments remain of the big manly Barry against crying, his brother's response to his pain demolishes. If what you are telling me is what I was, he begins, wasn't enough, then I'm telling you that what anybody is not enough. You got it. Exactly. We are not enough. We are none of us enough, including the man who does everything right. Doing things right, Jerry says with disgust. Going around in this world, doing things right. Look, are you going to break with appearances and pit your will against your daughter's, or aren't you? Out on the field, you did it. That's how you scored. Remember, you pitted your will against the other guys, and you scored. Pretend it's a game, if that helps. It doesn't help. For the typical male activity, you're there, the man of action. But this isn't the typical male activity. Okay. Can't see yourself doing that. Can only see yourself playing ball and making gloves and marrying Miss America. Out there with Miss America dumbing down and dulling out. Out there playing at being wasps. A little Mick girl from the Elizabeth Docks and a Jew boy from Weequahicai. The cows. Cow society. Colonial old America. And you thought all that facade was going to come without a cost? Genteel and innocent, but that cost, too, Seymour. I would have thrown a bomb. I would have become a giant and lived in Newark, the wasp bullshit. I didn't know just how entirely muffled you were internally. But this is how muffled you are. Our old man really swaddled you, but good. What do you want, Seymour? You want to bail out? That's all right, too. Anybody else would have bailed out a long time. Go ahead, bail out. Admit her contempt for your life and bail out. Admit there is something very personal about you that she hates and bail the fuck out and never see the bitch again. Admit that she's a monster, Seymour. Even a monster has to be from somewhere. Even a monster needs parents. But parents don't need monsters. Bail out. But if you're not going to bail out, if that's what you are calling to tell me, then for Christ's sakes, go in there and get her. I'll go in there and get her. How about that? Last chance. Last offer. You want me to come? I'll clear out the office, get on a plane, and I'll come. And I'll go in there, and I assure you, I'll get her off the Macarthur Highway, the little shit, the selfish little fucking shit, playing her fucking games with you. She won't play them with me, I assure you. You want that or not? I don't want that. These things, Jerry thinks he knows that he doesn't know. His idea is that things are connected. But there is no connection. How we lived and what she did? Where she was raised and what she did? It's as disconnected as everything else. It's all part of the same mess. He's the one who knows nothing. Jerry rants. Jerry thinks he can escape the bewilderment by ranting, shouting. But everything he shouts is wrong. None of this is true. Causes, clear answers, who there is to blame, reasons, but there are no reasons. She's obliged to be as she is. We all are. Reasons are in books. Could how we lived as a family ever have come back as this bizarre horror? It couldn't. It hasn't. Jerry tries to rationalize it, but he can't. This is all something else, something he knows absolutely nothing about. No one does. It's not rational. It's chaos. It is chaos from start to finish. I don't want that, the Swede tells him. I can't have that. Too brutal for you. In this world, too brutal. The daughter's a murderer, but this is too brutal. A drill instructor in the Marine Corps, but this is too brutal. Okay, big Swede. Gentle giant. I got a waiting room full of patients. You're on your own. Paradise Lost. It was the summer of the Watergate hearings. The Lvovs had spent nearly every night on the back porch watching the replay of the day's session on Channel 13. Before the farm equipment and the cattle had been sold off, it was from there, on warm evenings, that they looked out onto Dawn's herd grazing along the rim of the hill. Up a ways from the house was a field of 18 acres, and some years they'd have the cows up there all summer and forget them. But if they were merely out of sight nearby, and Mary, in her pajamas, wanted to see them before she went to bed, Dawn would call out, "Here, boy! Here, boy!" The kind of thing people had been calling to them for thousands of years. And they'd sound off in return and start up the hill and out from the swamp, come out of wherever they were, bellowing their response as they trudged toward the sound of Dawn's voice. "Aren't they beautiful, our girls?" Dawn would ask her daughter, and the next day, Mary and Dawn would be out at sunrise getting them all together again. And he'd hear Dawn say, "Okay, we're going to cross the road." And Mary would open the gate, and just with a stick and the dog, Alpu, the Australian sheepdog, mother and tiny daughter would move some 12 or 15 or 18 beasts, each weighing about 2,000 pounds. Mary, Apu, and Dawn sometimes the vet, and the boy down the road to help with the fencing and the haying when an extra hand was needed. I've got Mary to help me hay. If there's a stray calf, Mary gets after it. Seymour goes in there, and those two calves will be very unpleasant. They'll paw the grass, they'll shake their heads at him, but Mary goes in, well, they know her, and they just tell her what they want. They know her, and they know exactly what she's going to do with them. How could she ever say to him, I don't want to talk about my mother? What in God's name had her mother done? What crime had her mother committed? The crime of being gentle master to these compliant cows?
During this past week, while his parents had been with them, up from Florida for the annual late summer visit, Dawn hadn't even worried about keeping the two of them entertained. Whenever she returned from the new building site or drove back from the architect's office, they were seated before the set with the father-in-law in the role of assistant counsel to the committee. Her in-laws watched the proceedings all day and then saw the whole thing over again at night. In what time he had left to himself during the day, the Swede's father composed letters to the committee members which he read to everyone at dinner.
Dear Senator Weicker, you're surprised at what was going on in Tricky Dick's White House? Don't be a schnook. Harry Truman had him figured out in 1948 when he called him Tricky Dicky.
Dear Senator Gurney, Nixon equals Typhoid Mary. Everything he touches, he poisons, you included.
Dear Senator Baker, you want to know why?
Because they're a bunch of common criminals. That's why.
Dear Mr. Dash, he wrote to the committee's New York counsel,
I applaud you. God bless you. You make me proud to be an American and a Jew.
His greatest contempt, he reserved for a relatively insignificant figure, a lawyer named Kalmbach, who arranged for large, illegal contributions to sift into the Watergate operation, and whose disgrace could not be profound enough to suit the old man.
Dear Mr. Kalmbach, if you were a Jew and did what you did, the whole world would say, see, those Jews, real money grubbers. But who is the money grubber, my dear Mr. Country Club? Who is the thief and the cheat? Who is the American and who is the gangster?
Your smooth talk never fooled me, Mr. Country Club. Calm back. Your golf never fooled me. Your manners never fooled me. Your clean hands I always knew were dirty, and now the whole world knows you should be ashamed.
You think I'll get an answer from the son of a bitch?
I ought to publish these in a book. I ought to find somebody to print them up and just distribute them free so people can know what an ordinary American feels when these sons of a bitch... Look!
Look at that one. Look at him!
Ehrlichman, Nixon's former chief of staff, had appeared on the screen.
He makes me nauseous, the Swede's mother said. Him and that Trisha.
Please, please. She's unimportant, her husband said. This is a real fascist, the whole bunch of them.
Von Ehrlichman, von Haldeman, von Kalmbach.
She still makes me nauseous, his wife said.
You think she was a princess, the way they carry on about her?
These so-called patriots, Lulavov said to Dawn, would take the country and make Nazi Germany out of it.
You know the book, It Can't Happen Here?
There's a wonderful book. I forget the author, but the idea couldn't be more up to the moment. These people have taken us to the edge of something terrible. Look at that son of a bitch.
I don't know which one I hate more, his wife said. Him or the other one?
They're the same thing, the old man told her. They're interchangeable, the whole bunch of them.
Mary's legacy. That his father might have been no less incensed if she were there, sitting with them all in front of the set, the Swede recognized. But now that she was gone, who better was there to hate for what had become of her than these Watergate bastards? It was during the Vietnam War that Lulavov had begun mailing Mary copies of the letters he sent to President Johnson, letters he had written to influence Mary's behavior more than the president's. Seeing his teenage granddaughter as enraged with the war as he could get, when things started to go wrong with the business, the old man became so distressed that he would take his son aside and say, why does she care? Where does she even get this stuff? Who feeds it to her? What's the difference to her anyway? Does she carry on like this at school? She can't do this at school. She could harm her chances at school. She can harm her chances for college. And in public, people won't put up with it. They'll chop her head off. She's only a child. To control, if he could, not so much Mary's opinions as the ferocity with which he sputtered them out, he would ostentatiously ally himself with her by sending articles clipped from the Florida papers and inscribed in the margins with his own anti-war slogans.
When he was visiting, he would read aloud to her from the portfolio of his Johnson letters that he carried around the house under his arm, in his effort to save her from herself, tagging after the child as though he were the child. "We gotta nip this in the bud," he confided to his son. "This won't do, not at all."
"Well," he'd say,
after reading to Mary yet another plea to the president, reminding him what a great country America was, what a great president FDR had been, how much his own family owed to this country, and what a personal disappointment it was to him and his loved ones that American boys were halfway around the world fighting somebody else's battle when they ought to be at home with their loved ones.
"Well, what do you think of your grandfather?"
"Johnson's a war criminal," she'd say. "He's not going to stop the war, Grandpa, because you tell him to."
"He's also a man trying to do his job, you know. He's an imperialist dog." "Well, that is one opinion."
"There's no difference between him and Hitler."
"You're exaggerating, sweetheart. I don't say Johnson didn't let us down. But you forget what Hitler did to the Jews, Mary dear. You weren't born then, so you don't remember."
"He did nothing that Johnson isn't doing to the Vietnamese."
"The Vietnamese aren't being put into concentration camps."
"Vietnam is one big camp. The American boys aren't the issue. That's like saying, get the stormtroopers out of Auschwitz in time for Christmas.
"I gotta be political with the guy, sweetheart. I can't write the guy and call him a murderer and expect that he's going to listen. Right, Seymour?"
"I don't think that would help," the Swede said. "Mary, we all feel the way you do," her grandfather told her.
"Do you understand that? Believe me, I know what it is to read the newspaper and start to go nuts. Father Coughlin, that son of a bitch.
The hero, Charles Lindbergh, pro-Nazi, pro-Hitler, and the so-called national hero in this country, Mr. Gerald L.K. Smith. The great Senator Bilbo, sure, we have bastards in this country, homegrown and plenty of them, nobody denies that. Mr. Rankin, Mr. Dyes and his committee, Mr. J. Parnell Thomas from New Jersey, isolationist, bigoted, know-nothing fascist right here in the U.S. Congress, crooks like J. Parnell Thomas, crooks who wound up in jail and their salaries were paid for by the U.S. taxpayer, awful people, the worst. Mr. McCarran, Mr. Jenner, Mr. Munt, the Goebbels from Wisconsin, the Honorable Mr. McCarthy, may he burn in hell, his sidekick, Mr. Cohn, a disgrace, a Jew and a disgrace. There's always been sons of bitches here, just like there are in every country, and they have been voted into office by all those geniuses out there who have the right to vote. And what about the newspapers? Mr. Hearst, Mr. McCormick, Mr. Westbrook Pegler, real fascist reactionary dogs, and I've hated their guts. Ask your father, haven't I, Seymour? Hated them?
You have.
Honey, we live in a democracy. Thank God for that. You don't have to go around getting angry with your family. You can write letters. You can vote. You can get up on a soapbox and make a speech. Christ, you can do what your father did. You can join the Marines.
Oh, Grandpa, the Marines are the prob.
Then damn it, Mary, join the other side, he said, momentarily losing his grip. How's that? You can join their Marines if you want to. It's been done. It's true. Look at history. When you're old enough, you can go over and fight for the other army if you want to do it. I don't recommend it. People don't like it, and I think you're smart enough to understand why they don't. Traitor isn't a pleasant thing to be called, but it's been done. It's an option. Look at Benedict Arnold. Look at him. He did it. He went over to the other side, as far as I remember, from school, and I suppose I respect him. He had guts. He stood up for what he believed in. He risked his own life for what he believed in. But he happened to be wrong, Mary, in my estimation. He went over to the other side in the Revolutionary War, and as far as I'm concerned, the man was dead wrong. Now, you don't happen to be wrong. You happen to be right. This family is 100% against the goddamn Vietnam thing. You don't have to rebel against your family because your family is not in disagreement with you. You're not the only person around here against the war. We're against it. Bobby Kennedy is against it. Now, said Murray with disgust. Okay, now. Now is better than not now, isn't it? Be realistic, Mary. It doesn't help anything not to be. Bobby Kennedy is against it, Senator Eugene McCarthy is against it, Senator Javits is against it, and he's a Republican. Senator Frank Church is against it, Senator Wayne Morse is against it. Oh, and how he is, I admire that man. I've written to tell him, and I've gotten the courtesy of a hand-signed reply. Senator Fulbright, of course, is against it. It's Fulbright who admittedly introduced the Tonkin Gulf nobody is saying, Dad, said the sweetlet. Mary, finish. I'm sorry, honey, said Lulu, finish. Fulbright is a racist.
Is he? What are you talking about?
Senator William Fulbright from Arkansas?
Oh, come on with that stuff.
I think that's where you got your facts wrong, my friend. She had slandered one of his heroes who stood up to Joe McCarthy, and to prevent himself from lashing out at her about Fulbright took a supreme effort of will. But now, just let me finish what I was saying. What was I saying? Where was I? Where the hell was I, Seymour?
Your point, the Swede said, acting even-handedly as the moderator for these two dynamos, a role he preferred to being the adversary of either, is that both of you are against the war and want it to stop. There's no reason for you to argue on that issue. I believe that's your point. Mary feels it's all gone beyond writing letters to the president. She feels that's futile. You feel that, futile or not, it's something within your power to do, and you're going to do it, at least to continue to put yourself on record.
Exactly, the old man cried. Here, listen to what I tell him here. I am a lifetime Democrat. Mary, listen. I am a lifetime Democrat.
But nothing he told the president ended the war, nor did anything he told Mary nip the catastrophe in the bud. Yet, alone in the family, he had seen it coming. I saw it coming. I saw it clear as day. I saw it. I knew it. I sensed it. I fought it. She was out of control. Something was wrong. I could smell it. I told you, something has to be done about that child. Something is going wrong with that child. And it went in one ear and out the other. I got, Dad, take it easy. I got, Dad, don't exaggerate. Dad, it's a phase. Lou, leave her alone. Don't argue with her. No, I will not leave her alone. This is my granddaughter. I refuse to leave her alone. I refuse to lose a granddaughter by leaving her alone. Something is haywire with that child. And you looked at me like I was nuts, all of you. Only I wasn't nuts. I was right. With a vengeance, I was right.
There were no messages for him when he got home. He had been praying for a message from Mary Stoltz.
Nothing, he said to Dawn, who was in the kitchen preparing a salad out of greens she'd pulled from the garden.
Nope. He poured a drink for himself and his father and carried the glasses out to the back porch where the set was still on.
You going to make a steak, darling? His mother asked him.
Steak, corn, salad, and Mary's big beefsteak tomatoes.
He meant Dawn's tomatoes, but he didn't correct himself once it was out.
No one makes a steak like you, she said after the first shock of his words had worn off.
Good, Ma.
My big boy. Who could want a better son, she said, and when he embraced her, she went to pieces for the first time that week.
I'm sorry. I was remembering the phone calls.
I understand, he said.
She was a little girl. You'd call. You'd put her on and she'd say, Hi, Grandma. Guess what?
I don't know, honey. What?
And she'd tell me.
Come on. You've been terrific so far. You can keep it up. Come on. Buck up.
I was looking at the snapshots when she was a baby.
Don't look at them, he said. Try not to look at them. You can do it, Ma. You have to.
Oh, darling, you're so brave. You're such an inspiration. Such a tonic when we come to see you. I love you so.
Good, Ma. I love you. But you mustn't lose control in front of Dawn.
Yes, yes. Whatever you say.
That's my girl. His father, continuing to watch the television set, and after having miraculously contained himself for 10 full days, said to him,
No news.
No news, the Swede replied. Nothing, nothing.
Okay, his father said, feigning fatalism. Okay, if that's the way it is, that's the way it is.
And went back to watching TV.
Do you still think she's in Canada, Seymour? His mother asked.
I never thought she was in Canada. But that's where the boys went. Look, why don't we save this discussion?
There's nothing wrong with asking questions, but Dawn will be in and out. I'm sorry, you're right, his mother replied. I'm terribly sorry.
Not that the situation has changed, Mother. Everything is exactly the same.
Seymour, she hesitated.
Darling, one question. If she gave herself up now, what would happen? Your father says, why are you bothering him with that? His father said. He told you about Dawn. Learn to control yourself.
Me? control myself?
Mother, you must stop thinking these thoughts. She is gone. She may never want to see us again.
Why?
His father erupted.
Of course she wants to see us again. This I refuse to believe.
Now, who's controlling himself? His mother asked.
Of course she wants to see us again. The problem is she can't.
Lou, dear, his mother said.
There are children, even in ordinary families, who grow up and go away, and that's the end of it.
But not at 16, for Christ's sake. Not under these circumstances. What are you talking about, ordinary families? We're an ordinary family.
This is a child who needs help. This is a child who is in trouble, and we are not a family who walks out on a child in trouble.
She's 20 years old, Dad. 21.
21, his mother said, last January.
Well, she's not a child, the sweet told him.
All I'm saying is that you must not set yourself up for disappointment, neither of you.
Well, I don't, his father said. I have more sense than that. I assure you, I don't.
Well, you mustn't. I seriously doubt that we'll ever see her again. The only thing worse than their never seeing her again would be their seeing her as he had left her on the floor of that room. Over these last few years, he had been moving them in the direction, if not of total resignation, of adaptation, of a realistic appraisal of the future. How could he now tell them what had happened to Murray? Find words to describe it to them that would not destroy them. They haven't the faintest picture in their mind of what they'd see if they were to see her. Why does anyone have to know? What is so indispensable about any of them knowing?
You've got reason to say that, son, that we'll never see her?
The 5 years, the time that's gone by, that's reason enough. Seymour, sometimes I'm walking on the street and I'm behind someone, a girl, who's walking in front of me, and if she's tall, he took his mother's hands in his.
You think it's Mary?
Yes. That happens to all of us. I can't stop it. I understand. And every time the phone rings, she said, I know. I tell her, his father said, that she wouldn't do it with a phone call anyway. And why not, she said to her husband, why not phone us? That's the safest thing she could possibly do, to phone us. Ma, none of this speculation means anything. Why not try to keep it to a minimum tonight? I know you can't help having these thoughts. You can't be free of it. None of us can be. But you have to try. You cannot make happen what you want to happen just by thinking about it. Try to free yourself from a little of it.
Whatever you say, darling, his mother replied.
I feel better now just talking about it. I can't keep inside me all the time.
I know.
But we can start whispering around dawn. It was never difficult, as it was with his restless father, who spent so much of life in a transitional state between compassion and antagonism, between comprehension and blindness, between gentle intimacy and violent irritation, to know what to make of his mother. He had never feared battling with her, never uncertainly wondered what side she was on or worried what she might be inflamed by next. Unlike her husband, she was a big industry of nothing other than family love. Hers was a simple personality for whom the well-being of the boys was everything. Talking to her, he'd felt, since earliest boyhood, as though he was stepping directly into her heart. With his father, to whose heart he had easy enough access, he had first to collide with that skull, the skull of a brawler, to split it open as bloodlessly as he could to get at whatever was inside. It was astonishing how small a woman she had become. But what hadn't been consumed by osteoporosis had, in the last 5 years, been destroyed by Mary. Now the vivacious mother of his youth, who well into middle age was being complimented on her youthful vigor, was an old lady, her spine twisted and bent, a hurt and puzzled expression embedded in the creases of her face. Now, when she didn't realize people were watching her, tears would rise in her eyes bearing that look both long accustomed to living with pain and startled to have been in so much pain so long. Yet all his boyhood recollections, which, however hard to credit, he knew to be genuine, even the ruthlessly unillusioned Jerry would, if asked, have to corroborate them, were of his mother towering over the rest of them, a healthy, tall, reddish blonde with a wonderful laugh, who adored being the woman in that masculine household. As a small child,
He had not found it nearly so odd and amazing as he did looking at her now, to think that you could recognize people as easily by their laugh as by their face. Hers, back when she had something to laugh about, was light and like a bird in flight, rising, rising, and then delightfully, if you were her child, rising yet again. He didn't even have to be in the same room to know where his mother was. He'd hear her laughing and could pinpoint her on the map of the house that was not so much in his brain as it was his brain. His cerebral cortex divided not into frontal lobes, parietal lobes, temporal lobes, and occipital lobes, but into the downstairs, the upstairs, the basement, the living room, the dining room, the kitchen, etc. What had been oppressing her when she arrived from Florida the week before was the letter she was carrying secreted in her purse, a letter addressed by Lulavov to the second wife Jerry had left, from whom he had only recently separated. Sylvia Lvov had been given a stack of letters to mail by her husband, but that one she simply could not send. Instead, she had dared to go off alone and open it, and now she had brought the contents north with her to show Seymour. You know what would happen with Jerry if Susan never got this? You know the rampage Jerry would go on? He's not a boy without a temper. He never was. He's not you, dear. He is not a diplomat. But your father has to stick his nose in everywhere, and what the results will be means nothing to him so long as he's got his nose in the wrong place. All he has to do is send to this and put Jerry in the wrong like this, and there will be hell to pay with your brother, unmitigated hell. The letter, 2 pages long, began, Dear Susie, the check enclosed is for you and for nobody else's information. It is found money. Put it somewhere where nobody knows about it. I'll say nothing, and you say nothing. I want you to know that I have not forgotten you in my will. This money is yours to do whatever you want with. The children I'll take care of separately, but if you decide to invest it, and I strongly hope you do, my suggestion is gold stocks. The dollar isn't going to be worth a thing. I myself have just put 10,000 into 3 gold stocks. I'll give you the names. Bennington Mines, Castwork Development, Schleswig Mineral Corp, Solid Investments. I got the names from the Barrington newsletter that has never steered me wrong yet. Stapled to the letter, stapled, so that when she opened the letter, the enclosure didn't just flutter away to get lost under the sofa. There was a check made out to Susan R. Lvov for $7,500. A check for twice that amount had gone off to her the day after she had called, sobbing and screaming for help, to say that Jerry had left her that morning for the new nurse in his office. The position of new nurse in the office was one that she herself had occupied before Jerry began the affair with her that ended in his divorcing his first wife. According to the Swede's mother, after Jerry found out about the check for $15,000, he proceeded over the phone to call his father every name in the book. And that night, for the first time in his life, Lulavov had chest pain that necessitated her calling their doctor at 2 a.m. And now, 4 months later, he was at it again. Seymour, what should I do? He goes around screaming. A second divorce, a second broken family, more grandchildren in a broken home, 3 more wonderful children without parental guidance. You know how he goes on. It's on and on. It's over and over till I think I'm going out of my mind. Where did my son get so good at getting divorced? Who in the history of this entire family has ever been divorced? No one. I cannot take it anymore, dear. He screams at me. Why doesn't your son just go to a whorehouse, marry a whore out of a whorehouse, and get it over with? He'll get in another fight with Jerry, and Jerry doesn't pull his punches. Jerry doesn't have your considerateness. He never did. When they had that fight about the coat, when Jerry made that coat out of the hamsters, do you remember? Maybe you were in the service by then. Hamster skins Jerry got somewhere, I think at school, and made them into a coat for some girl. He thought he was doing her a favor, but she received this thing, I think by mail, in a box all wrapped up, and it smelled to high heaven, and the girl burst into tears, and her mother telephoned, and your father was fit to be tied. He was mortified. And they had an argument, he and Jerry, and it scared me to death. A 15-year-old boy, and he screamed so at his own father. His rights, you could have heard him on Broad and Market about his rights. Jerry does not back down. He doesn't know the meaning of back down. But now we won't be shouting at a man who is 45. He'll be shouting at a man who is 75 and with angina.
And this time it won't be indigestion afterwards. There won't be a headache. This time there will be a full-scale heart attack. There won't be a heart attack, Mother. Calm down. Did I do the wrong thing? I never touched another person's mail in my life, but how could I let him send this to Susan? Because she won't keep it to herself. She'll do what she did the last time. She'll use it against Jerry. She'll tell him. And this time, Jerry will kill him. Jerry won't kill him. He doesn't want to kill him, and he won't mail it, Mama. You still have the envelope? Yes. It isn't torn? You didn't tear it? I'm ashamed to tell you, it's not torn. I used steam. But I don't want him to drop dead. He won't. He hasn't yet. You stay out of it, Ma. Mail Susan the envelope with the check, with the letter, and when Jerry calls, you just go out and you take a walk. And when he gets chest pains again, if he gets chest pains again, you'll call the doctor again. You stay out of it. You cannot intervene to protect him from himself. It's too late in the day for that. Oh, thank goodness I have you. You're the only one I can turn to. All your own troubles, all you've gone through, and you're the only one in this family who says things to me that are not completely insane.
Dawn's holding up, his father asked. She's doing fine.
She looks like $1 million, his father said. That girl looks like herself again. Getting rid of those cows was the smartest thing you ever did. I never liked them. I never saw why she needed them. Thank God for that facelift. I was against it, but I was wrong. Dead wrong. I got to admit it. That guy did a wonderful job. Thank God our Dawn doesn't look any more like all that she went through. He did do a great job, the Swede said. Erased all that suffering. He gave her back her face. No longer does she have to look in the mirror at the record of her misery. Been a brilliant stroke. She had got the thing out from directly in front of her. But she's waiting. I see it, Seymour. A mother sees such things. Maybe you erase the suffering from the face, but you can't remove the memory inside. Under that face, the poor thing is waiting.
Dawn's not a poor thing, Ma. She's a fighter. She's fine. She's made tremendous strides.
True. All the while, he has been stoically enduring it. She has made tremendous strides by finding it unendurable, by being devastated by it, destroyed by it, and then by denuding herself of it. She doesn't resist the blows the way he does. She receives the blows, falls apart, and when she gets herself up again, decides to make herself over.
Nothing that is inadmirable in that. Abandoned first the face, assaulted by the child. Abandoned next the house, assaulted by the child. This is her life, after all, and she will get the original Dawn up and going again if it's the last thing she does. Ma, let's stop this. Come on outside with me while I start the coals.
No, his mother said, looking ready to cry again. Thank you, darling. I'll stay here with Daddy and watch the television.
You watched it all day. Come outside and help me.
No, thank you, dear.
She's waiting for them to get Nixon on, his father said. When they get Nixon on and drive a stake through his heart, your mother will be in seventh heaven.
And you won't, she said.
He can't sleep, she told the Swede, because of that mumza. He's up in the middle of the night writing him letters. Some I have to censor myself. I have to physically stop him. The language is so filthy.
That skunk, the Swede's father said bitterly. That miserable fascist dog.
And out of him, with terrifying force, poured a tirade of abuse, vitriol about the President of the United States that, absent the stuttering that never failed to impart to her abhorrence the exterminating adamance of a machine gun, Mary herself couldn't have topped in her heyday. Nixon liberates him to say anything, as Johnson liberated Mary. It's as though in his uncensored hatred of Nixon, Lulavov is merely mimicking his granddaughter's vituperous loathing of LBJ. Get Nixon. Get the bastard in some way. Get Nixon and all will be well. If we can just tar and feather Nixon, America will be America again without everything loathsome and lawless that's crept in. Without all the violence and malice and madness and hate. Put him in a cage. Cage the crook. And we'll have our great country back the way it was. Dawn ran in from the kitchen to see what was wrong, and soon they were all in tears, holding one another, huddled together, and weeping on that big old back porch as though the bomb had been planted right under the house, and the porch was all that was left of the place. And there was nothing the Swede could do to stop them or to stop himself. The family had never seemed so wrecked as this. Despite all that he had summoned up to lessen the aftershock of the day's horror and to prevent himself from cracking, despite the resolve with which he had rearmed himself after hurrying through the underpass and finding his car still there, undamaged, where he had left it on that grim down-neck street, despite the resolve with which he had for a second time rearmed himself after Jerry pummeled him on the phone, despite the resolve he had to summon up a third time beneath the razor ribbon of his parking lot fence with the key to his car in his hand, despite the self-watchfulness, despite the painstaking impersonation of impregnability, despite the elaborate false front of self-certainty with which he was determined to protect those he loved from the force she had killed, he had merely to misspeak, to say Mary's big beefsteak tomatoes instead of Dawn's, for them to sense that something unsurpassingly awful had happened. In addition to the Lvovs, there were six guests for dinner that evening. The first to arrive were Bill and Jesse Orcutt, Dawn's architect and his wife, who had been friendly enough neighbors a few miles down the road all these years in Orcutt's old family house, and became acquaintances and then dinner guests when Bill Orcutt began designing the new Lvov home. Orcutt's family had long been the prominent legal family in Morris County, lawyers, judges, state senators. As president of the local Landmark Society, already established as the historical conscience of a new conservationist generation, Orcutt had been a leader in the losing battle to keep Interstate 287 from cutting through the historical center of Morristown and a victorious opponent of the jetport that would have destroyed the Great Swamp just west of Chatham, and with it much of the county's wildlife. He was trying now to keep Lake Hopatcong from devastation by pollutants. Orcutt's bumper sticker read, "Morris Green, quiet and clean," and he good-naturedly slapped one on the Swede's car the first time they met. "Need all the help we can get," he said, "to keep the modern ills at bay." Once he learned that his new neighbors were originally city kids, to whom the rural Morris Highlands was an unknown landscape, he volunteered to take them on a county tour, one that, as it turned out, went on all one day and would have extended into the next had not the Swede lied and said he and Dawn and the baby had to be in Elizabeth at his in-laws Sunday morning. Dawn had said no to the tour right off. Something in Orcutt's proprietary manner had irritated her at that first meeting, something she found gratingly egotistical in his expansive courtesy, causing her to believe that to this young country squire with the charming manners she was nothing but laughable lace-curtain Irish, a girl who somehow got down the knack of aping her betters so as now to come ludicrously barging into his privileged backyard. The confidence. That's what unstrung her, that great confidence. Sure, she'd been Miss New Jersey, but the Swede had seen her on a few occasions with these rich Ivy League guys in their Shetland sweaters. Her affronted defensiveness always came as a surprise. She didn't seem ever to feel deficient in confidence until she met them and felt the class sting. "I'm sorry," she'd say. "I know it's just my Irish resentment, but I don't like being looked down on." And as much as this resentment of hers had always secretly attracted him, in the face of hostility, he thought proudly, "My wife is no pushover," it perturbed and disappointed him as well. He preferred to think of Dawn as a young woman of great beauty and accomplishment who was too renowned to have to feel resentful. "The only difference between them and us," by them she meant Protestants, "is on our side a little more liquor, and not much at that." My new Celtic neighbor and her Hebrew husband. I can hear him already with the other knobs. I'm sorry. If you can do it, that's fine with me, but I, for one, cannot revere his contempt for our embarrassing origins. The mainspring of Orcutt's character, and this she was sure of without having even to speak to him, was knowing all too well just how far back he and his manners reached into the genteel past. And so she stayed at home the day of the tour, perfectly content to be alone with the baby. Her husband, in Orcutt, promptly at 8, headed diagonally to the northwest corner of the county and then, backtracking, followed the southward meandering spine of the old iron mines. Orcutt, all the while recounting the glory days of the 19th century, when iron was king. Millions of tons pulled from this very ground. Starting from Hibernia and boomed